Would you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. Hi, it's Audra May.
Was LA scary at age 19?
No, I don't think that I was in touch enough with reality for it to be scary. You know what I mean?
So you just were like, I'm going to have a career and I'm going to go to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And I'm going to show up and I'm going to be a star.
No, it was more like, I can't stay in Murfreesboro, Tennessee anymore. I don't like it. Flunking out of school because all I do is write songs all day. I have to do something. I don't want to stay here and punish myself doing something I don't like that costs a lot of money. So I'd rather be in LA, so I'll go to LA.
All right. So now, take me, because now I haven't seen Tennessee anywhere. So now we'll circle back to Oklahoma. But take me sort of out of Oklahoma there, because obviously somehow you got to Tennessee. I didn't know anything. Now I'm totally, totally confused. Help me out here.
Well, I was raised in music theater. I've been on stage since I was 4, playing different characters and things like that. I was a goofball. And when I turned 17, I kind of stopped relating to it. Now I want to go back and do it. But back then, I kind of just stopped wanting anything to do with it. I was really burnt out on it. And I had all these scholarships to go to college for it, which just was more pressure. And, you know, eventually it was just like, I can't do this.
So you mean the whole idea of formalizing what you were doing, which to you was play up until then?
I guess, yeah. I guess that's a good way to put it. I never actually was able to put it into words. It was kind of a bizarre thing. I just stopped relating to reading other people's words. Whereas before, I could pick up a script and just get it. I couldn't get it anymore. It was like I just started sucking at it.
like a switch just flipped.
Yeah. And it happened at the same time that I was learning how to play guitar and piano and started kind of writing songs. And I think it just felt wrong and writing felt more right. And so I went toward that.
But how
I
did
went
you
to
get
Tennessee
to Tennessee?
Because Middle Tennessee State University is a really good school for music industry, especially recording industry, to learn, you know, to be a producer and things like that. So I figured that was what I was supposed to do, is be a producer. I never thought that I would be a songwriter, I'd be the person making the music, till about a year later, and I just had to get out of there.
So this school is kind of like a direct feed to Nashville, and next thing you know, you're writing for all, co-writing for all the big Nashville people. Was that
if you're lucky, you know, like in quotes,
right?
You know?
Then, so you picked up, you went to law, you left Tennessee. So somewhere in the midst, so you went to the college for how long?
A year.
So a year, and into it, you just kind of said to yourself again, I don't want to be the producer, I want to be the performer and the songwriter.
It happened more from the outside of myself than from knowing innately, you know, this isn't what I want to do. I was noticing all I was doing was passing the buildings where I was supposed to be going to class and going into the music building every day. And every day I would think, you're not supposed to do this, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do this, like you need to go to class.
It's kind of like a drug without drugs.
Yeah. And I'd go in that music building and they had these speakers and microphones built into the wall, so you could go to a keypad and push a button and sound like wherever you wanted to be, whether it was an arena or a cathedral. It was the perfect escape. I'd spend all day in there on my way to gym class and never make gym and never make humanities, and just completely I would sleep through finals, or I'd wake up at 7 a.m. to go get my final, you know, done, and I'd go and it was yesterday, you know, stuff like that. And it was just like, what? I don't want to be here. But I didn't know that I didn't want to be there. I just kept seemingly failing.
And what did your parents think of all of this?
Oh, they were nervous. I mean, my parents actually have always been really supportive. They're all sort of
yeah, we're gonna get there.
Yeah, they're bohemians, but my grandmother has always been the more sort of grounded, you know, like logical person. You know, she's a math lady. But she was the one who was kind of like, you know, don't you want to stay and finish something? And it was like, no.
No, I don't.
No, I don't. She was very nervous, but she's not nervous anymore. So that's good.
By nature of everybody's writing and everything they're saying, this is not a rock and roll album.
No.
Of course, I say that joking around because rock, you know, was Leslie Gore rock and roll? Well, yeah, Leslie Gore was rock and roll. And was Patsy Cline rock and roll? Yes, Patsy Cline was rock and roll because how many? It would be no cowboy junkies.
No, she was like the girl Buddy Holly.
Yeah, there would be there would be no cowboy junkies or a million other artists if there was no Patsy Cline.
That's right.
But by nature of the fact that this is not a rock and roll album, it's getting played on a lot of college radio stations and in a lot of next to a lot of rock and roll, including my shows. And, you know, that must feel pretty good.
Well, yeah. I listen to all kinds of music.
Yeah.
From everywhere, whether it's got words to it or not, and whether it's in English or not and all that. And are you kidding? I wanted to sing like Robert Plant when I was little. I would study him. I wanted my voice to be able to sound like an electric guitar like his does. And now there's people out, you know, singing who sort of do the same effect. People like Jack White, you know, throw that stank on it. And I'm just like, oh, I want to be stanky like that, you know.
So here you are at your first South by Southwest, but you kind of went there with a little buzz factor, didn't you?
I guess. I'm honestly, and anyone who knows me can kind of tell you, I'm sort of oblivious to things like that. There's people around me who will let me know and kind of clue me into it.
Right.
But I really try not to think about it or read about it or if I try not to seek it out because it's less fun.
Exactly.
It's a lot more like playing if you just do it and you're not worried about who's waiting for you to be there.
But were you amazed because you knew who you were surrounding? I mean, and admittedly, because it's Austin, there's always sort of a cadre of the Bonnie Raitt-like singer-songwriters.
Yeah.
I mean, there are that does exist there because it is where it is, but it's still a rock and roll, indie rock music fest. So was that kind of daunting for you? Or again, were you innocent to it and just said, oh, heck, I'll just show up and play?
No, that was absolutely daunting. I was really nervous, you know, because I always wanted to be everybody's best friend. I was nervous that, you know, my stuff wasn't cool enough. You know, there's all these super, you know, hip bands that I listen to on a daily basis. And to suddenly be in the same festival with them and be playing a show that, you know, that was good. We got to play at the Driscoll and it was, you know,
you had a great venue.
Yeah, it was, you know, that I was really grateful for because I played a couple hotel lobby shows too. And I knew a lot of people who were only doing that because, you know, they just wanted to be there with everybody. And so, you know, I was excited. But yeah, it was really daunting. But then once I got there and I was walking down 6th Street and I sort of saw street performers and people. There were people performing on the street because they weren't performing at South By, and there were people performing on the street because they were. And there were bands that normally were total rock and roll, like electric, just in a semicircle, singing and playing tambourine and guitar. And it was like musicians Mardi Gras. So I cooled out after that. I sort of realized we're all here because we love it, and there's no weird, no one's going to be a meanie or a bully.
But you put on a show, and that also comes from that their theater background of yours.
Oh, yeah, of
right?
course. Yeah, of course. I mean, my stepmom, you know, I call her Mama Toby. She taught me everything I know about performing on stage. She used to line us up. She ran a music theater camp when I was little, and she would line us up on stage, and she'd say, all right, one at a time. You walk across that stage and you hold your shoulders back and you say, my name is whatever your name is, and you say something you love about yourself. And these, you know, people would go up. I'd go up there. I'd give my attitude. You know, I'd be like, oh, hey, much me. Try to, like, you know, be a class clown about it. And she'd go, nope, do it again. You don't look confident. You look like you're nervous about what your friends want to say about you. And so it just taught me to, like, not care, to go up there and realize that moment when you're up there, that's the only time you get to do that right then, that day, you know? So you just, like, have as much fun with it as you possibly can. And I find that when I don't care about what the audience, you know, whether they like me or not, and I focus more on whether they're into it or not, it's a better show. It's just, I can let go more. And then once they're with you, you just can go and they'll follow you. It's
yeah, fun. It gives you the freedom to be insane.
Exactly.
Exactly. So I have to go here because it's like moral obligation. Okay, so we know your dad was an actor. We know your mom ran a children's theater. And then there's that their family heritage. So, and of course, that always gets moved to the front because being the, you are the, you're the grand niece.
I think so.
Is it the grandniece of Judy Garland and then the niece of Liza Minnelli? Would that be the correct family heritage?
No,
thing?
See, it's not even that cool. It's so much farther removed. And that's what's funny is I always kind of feel
weird about
it.
But that's why I'm
doing
it this way.
Yeah, you know, yeah. She, I think, and I've never met.
Everybody you know, wants you to own this, so this is a rare opportunity.
Well, they want me to say, what they want me to say is they want me to say, oh, yes, I, when I was 10 years old, my dear cousin Liza showed up to my house and she gave me a ring that was owned by Judy Garland. No,
right.
That's not, it's like, it's not, we didn't, my mother was so, this is Mama Lonnie now, my real mom, this is, she was so into, you know, putting it in my head that I was good enough and could do it by myself. You know, so
that
I
was
never
pushed on you when you're a kid. Like,
no.
You are the descendant of Dorothy.
No, but I mean, once you tell a kid that, they're never going to forget it.
Right.
I never forgot it, and I was never ashamed of it. I've never been ashamed of it. I think it's wonderful.
But
it's
you
only
don't,
been
but
now
you don't
that
own
I,
it, though. But you don't use it as your ownership of who you are.
It's part of who I am because
right.
It's in my veins right now.
Right.
And that's
right.
All it needs to be. That's all. I mean, that's priceless. What else do I need from it?
Exactly.
The rest of it, I can go on ahead and do myself.
But what's interesting, though, is that the, and I'm not going to harp on it too much, but it's always intriguing because, you know, you do your research and, you know, it's pushed so far up
yeah.
in the bio.
Yeah.
So do you think that maybe it'll just get pushed further and further back as time goes on?
Who knows? I think things of interest about people's lives come to the forefront and get pushed back depending on what's happening in pop culture.
Right.
You know what I mean? If something comes out about The Wizard of Oz and it's popular at the time, people are going to ask me more about it. You know what I mean? I mean, it's the same way with anybody who comes from a long line of performers and the performers before them happen to have had, you know, extreme recognition for their talent. It's always going to show up.
I love the way this was written up, that your uncle had a song on the reissue of Thriller.
Yeah, because he actually had a song on Thriller, and then when they put the record out...
They cut it.
So for, I guess, 25 years, he was telling everybody, no, I had a song on Thriller.
And they're like, where's that song, man?
But he's also like, I mean, that's the other thing. Like, that's one, when I talk about my uncle, that's what people want to talk about it. But he writes commercials, the eBay commercials. He did that stuff. I did it eBay. He puts my great-grandpa, his
So is he a jingle dad. Writer?
Yeah, sometimes. And he writes all kinds of stuff. He's never had to work a restaurant job. He's been doing music since he was 16, 17 years old on the road. I mean, the guy's a total freak. He's wonderful.
And I want to get past this, and then we're going to switch completely over to this.
Cool.
My favorite thing about it really is the way that you describe it, which is that it really is the only original song that is on her album.
Yeah, it is. They were...
Oh, we're talking about Susan Boyle, by the way. We should mention the name just to do our job here.
It's kind of important.
Yeah, it's real. You're right. We're talking about some lady from the UK who had 12 million friggin'
YouTube... Who inspired women all across
12
the world.
Million friggin' YouTube views, and everybody was like, who's she and who cares? And then the album comes out, and they're like, ha, gotcha.
Yeah, yeah she... Basically, I'd been writing with Play Production for about a year and a half and through my publishing company, and we just got along really well, and it was always more like play to write songs with them, which is appropriate because
yes,
of their name.
Exactly.
Anyway, they sent me an email that said, hey, we have this track for Susan Boyle. You know, I don't know if you've heard of her. Her label really likes it. It doesn't have any words yet. They're saying they're not putting any original songs on the record. It's only going to be covers, but they said they really like the track. So maybe, you know, they said it would be cool if you took a crack at the words. So I thought, well, sure. So I Googled her. I call Google the Oracle. I consulted the Oracle.
Right.
And,
right.
And learned about her life not everything she's been through, but some of the key points. And it was very inspiring for me, and I wanted to give her a song, and it was a long shot, but I wanted to give her a song that was only her song that no one else had ever sung before, so that she didn't feel like she was putting herself out there as someone who just sings these songs you've always heard a million times. You know, she needed something fresh. She needed
yeah.
something that she could sing at the top of her lungs that would make her feel good about herself, because she made so many people feel so good about themselves just by being herself. So I wrote the words, and I wanted to make it about just being a late bloomer and how that's okay, and how if that's who you are, then that's who you are and that's your path, and someday, you know, you will bloom, and you know, things like, you know, those metaphors and things like that are in the song. So anyway, we wrote it, and it was a while before we heard back, and a lot of people said no, it's never gonna work. And then all of a sudden,
boom.
Yeah. And I was really proud of it. I really liked the song, and I thought it was cool.
And I would imagine that financially, without going into details, that's almost better than getting a sync on Gossip Girl. Which we're gonna get to sync.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I would think there are a lot of things better than getting a sync on Gossip Girl. Not that I wouldn't be stoked about that. But yeah, it was, I guess financially it was a good thing. To me, all I cared about was her getting that song, and then somehow from that came, you're all right. You can pay rent now. You can eat. You don't have to worry about that anymore.
Exactly.
That I'm proud of that.
But your version of Forever Young was also pretty darn well received on television.
Well, yeah, it's kind of unfair to call it my version, because the track was done by Bob Thiel, the music guy for the show, Sons of Anarchy.
Music supervisor, yeah. Right.
And he, they called again my publishing company, and they said, we need someone who sounds country but not country. And they said, well, we have this girl named Audra May. So I went in to sing it. You know, it was kind of like, well, we'll see if her voice fits. So it was more of a collaboration, really. All I really did was sing it. I didn't like produce it or anything like that. But it was really fun.
I played a track from Joan Baez from 1970, where it was a whole cover, you know, covers of Dylan. So people have been doing this forever. But the fact that yours called attention to it, you obviously brought some sort of different soul to it as you were singing it.
I guess. I don't know if I'm, I mean, it's kind of bizarre, you know, Dennis, it's like this stuff that happens to me happens from inside my head. Everyone else gets it a lot better because they're outside, so they can see it. And sometimes because I'm the one doing it, I'm kind of blind to it. Do you
know what I mean? You're not sitting there predisposing what happens.
No, but I really liked, I mean, it sounds silly to say, well, I really like the words to that song. Of course you like the words to that song. It's absolutely beautiful. People send me messages saying, you know, my baby goes to sleep to this at night. We played this at a funeral for a fellow fallen police officer, you know, things like that. And I think as much as, yes, it's because I enjoyed singing the song, you know, if you don't have words to sing that you enjoy, you know, what's the point?
So do you think that, you know, again, without being on the outside, it seems like your makeup is going to be performer and songwriter for others, that you're going to do yours, and then you're going to do the Bonnie Raitt or Linda Perry or whatever it is, where you're just going to naturally fall into people saying, we love you doing that song, but you know what, we also want something, and you're going to be complete, because some people get in that mode where they say, you know what, I'm doing my own stuff, and that's all, I'm only doing this for me, but it doesn't sound like that's going to be your thing.
No, I feel, and I think also having grown up in theater and enjoying playing different characters and telling different stories in that way, I don't see me ever only singing my own songs. I don't see me ever not letting other people sing my songs. I don't see me ever doing that thing where it's like, oh, I don't co-write. I don't ever co-write with people. You know what I mean? Some of my songs on my record, I wrote completely by myself in 5 minutes on my couch. Some of them I wrote with two of my good friends or one good friend who'd come over and we would just kind of hang out. I don't see a reason to make music or art like a competition or like a test or like school. It's like I completely lose inspiration when I look at it that way. It just goes away.
What's wrong with you? I mean, how can you be? come on, how can you be in this industry and be so egalitarian? That's just not.
Well, I still get, you know, envious when I see people doing stuff that I want to do, you know, but it more inspires me than.
Yeah, I think we all do, because that's just a natural human.
Oh, sure.
Human factor. These are not autobiographical per se. These are.
Some of them are.
Some of them are. Yeah. But you set out to write cool, interesting narrative stories.
Right.
And you did not set out to make the feel good record of the year.
No, but hopefully the next one will will make the feel-good record of the year, because I like to dance.
Even though it's called The Happiest Lamb.
Yes.
It's The Happiest Lamb. It's not really as happy as you would like it to
no,
be.
No, she's happy.
Right.
I mean, but in only her, because in her she world. Went through what she went through, right?
Right.
Yeah, so.
What is it like to play this album to folks that are just beginning to hear it on shows like mine?
It's great. I mean, when I wrote it, I set out to have songs that I could play a million times and not get tired of and, you know, want to shoot myself. So now that I've done that and I like playing the songs,
But the audience is new to these. So
yeah,
is it fun?
Some
is
of
it
them.
Fun to watch? And some of them, of course, have picked up on stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. We get, you know, one or two every night that actually, that are actually like fans, you know, before they come to the show, which is awesome, because I feel like, you know, it's not always going to happen where I get to talk to people personally and get to know them and shake their hand and stuff. So that's been really cool. I like the pacing.
Tell me about the producer.
Ted Hutt.
Yes.
Yes, Ted Hutt. Well, he does a lot of stuff for Side One Dummy. He did the Gaslight Anthem record. And he was in Flogging Molly a while ago. And when I signed with Side One, they said, we know a guy that we think you're going to mesh perfectly with. He has the same kind of taste that you have in music. And they were absolutely right. And at that time, I didn't really know yet how to put a cohesive sounding record together, make it sound like an album. Everything was sort of all over the place. I wanted to show everybody everything I could do. And he was very instrumental in making this record sound like an album rather than a resume.
So did you go in there? I mean, because you've listened to a lot of music, so did you go in there? Because it's a very, very classic sounding record.
Well, thank you.
It's got a warm bass in it, you know, and the vocals have got just that level of reverb that you would expect from
this Ted Hutt, I'm telling you, he knows how to record instruments and get them to sound wonderful. And his imagination is wonderful too, in the room, just working on things. You know, there's times where you think the song is only piano and vocal, like the Dolly Parton cover, Little Sparrow. At the end, it's not. If you listen closely, you can hear these sort of like tension sounds of electric guitar where he would just kind of knock it on the floor and let it ring out and then just put it back there for atmosphere. It's almost cinematic, you know, the way he does stuff. He taught me a lot, and I absorbed it like a sponge, and I can't wait to use it.
So this is a little game that I've done with over 300 bands and artists. And it's called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs is the bread, and then songs by anybody else you want to play in between.